listeners. This is Catherine Spires back for another week of Smart Mouth. And before we start the episode, I wanted to let you all know about the Smart Mouth Cookie Contest that's going on right now. If you have an excellent and previously unpublished cookie recipe that you want to share, you can enter the contest at smartmouthpodcast.com. Just do that before December 4th, 2018, for people who are listening in the future. And there are prizes too. So again, enter your cookie recipes at smartmouthpodcast.com for a chance to win some cookbooks and some gift cards and things like that. This week, our guest also generously offered to do a giveaway for us, which is cool. Just prizes left and right. She is Valerie Gordon. She's the owner of Valerie Confections here in Los Angeles. And she made a name for herself by recreating cake recipes that had been sort of lost to time. Her website is valerieconfections.com, and you can check out everything she has, which includes boxes of chocolates. And she very generously has offered to give away a box of chocolates to Smart Mouth listeners. And I think that'll be a cool little Christmas present, perhaps, something along those lines, or just eat it yourself. Actually, that's the thing to do, win it and eat it yourself. So you can enter to win this box of chocolates by either following Smart Mouth Podcast on Instagram and leaving a comment on the selfie of me and Valerie. Again, that's Smart Mouth Podcast on Instagram. Leave a comment on it. Or you can just tweet at Smart Mouth Pod and say something like chocolates. Please do that by December 1st, and then I will choose a winner at random. So on to the show. Hope you enjoy it. Valerie Gordon, thank you for being here with us. Taking a break from your baking schedule. Do you still do a lot of your own baking, or did you have to become more of like an administrator?
Currently, in the heat of the holiday season, which we are for sure in, I am doing more and more production time. I would say about 8 months out of the year, I do less production and I miss it. I miss it.
Right. Because it's the reason you got into it, right?
It's the reason I got into it. And I have to say my happiest days at work are when I'm in the kitchen.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I do, however, I cook a lot of brunch at our Echo Park Cafe also.
Okay.
I'm generally there Saturday mornings.
Oh.
Doing brunch.
So you like to be like busy.
I like to be busy. I do. It's a way of life.
Yeah, seriously. Uh-huh. So you go in for the busiest
I do.
Seasons and times of
yes.
day. All right.
There's okay. a thrill to that. Our company was actually born almost 15 years ago.
Oh my goodness.
I know.
You've really been doing it.
Mama's getting up there. I always say it's a quick road from ingenue to matron.
So I feel like, tell me if this is how you feel as well, because I feel like when you did the Blum's Coffee Crunch cake and then you did a couple of other recreations of some famous mid-century cakes, you really got a lot of attention
yes,
for those.
Absolutely. And it was sort of this wonderful journey that started in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And it was immediate attention and very emotional attention. And that was the thing that I really latched on to. It started with the Blum's Coffee Crunch cake. And that was really a personal journey of culinary excavation as well, because I grew up with that cake.
Okay.
So I had a really personal attachment to this cake.
So Blum's, and, we should tell people, yeah, is a little, was it like a little tea room kind of
place?
I
would not describe Blum's as a tea room. So Blum's had 8 locations throughout California. It was in Southern and Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
And what they had was a little kitschy.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, the coffee crunch cake was originally spelled with all K's.
I know. I noticed that. Coffee crunch cake
yes,
with K's.
All K's.
Everyone picture that in your head.
That's a lot to take in.
That was a mistake.
Let's stay with the sweets. So Blum's had 8 locations, varying sizes. Mm-hmm. So the one that was in Los Angeles, that was the biggest one, was on the corner of Beverly and Wilshire mm-hmm. in Beverly Hills. There was a great one on Polk Street in San Francisco. There was one right by a department store in San Francisco. There was one in Stonestown Galleria out there in the far Sunset. There was one in Pasadena here. So they were different sizes. They all had a slightly different exterior, but they also had a lot of pink and a lot of gold and very similar menus. Uh-huh. But they served savory food as well as confections and a lot of desserts, as well as they had a really fun Sunday menu also.
Yeah?
Yes. So they did like Coffiesta Sunday, which is something I've brought back as well, which used the same coffee honeycomb that is on the Blum's Coffee Crunch Cake. And then there was weird, like, you know, all these sort of like really kitschy sauce names. And like they had La Vie en Rose was one of their Sundays. So there was a real sense of fun okay. in what they did.
I see. Yes. And you grew up going to one of the ones in San Francisco, is that right?
It closed when I was very young.
Okay.
But there was an offshoot of Blum's called Fantasia mm-hmm. that was in an area called Laurel Village near Pacific Heights. And they continued to sell the coffee crunch cake there. And they also had a large selection of pétifors and other pastries there. It was a really, really lovely place.
And so the cake itself is it lemon vanilla?
So the cake itself is a chiffon cake mm-hmm. with a very delicate hint of lemon, mm-hmm. coffee, whipped cream, and coffee honeycomb.
Mm-hmm. And people just lose their minds.
People freak out over this cake. So this cake was alive originally for about 40 years, and then it went extinct. It has been sort of co-opted by some Asian bakeries. There's one in Japantown in San Francisco that carries a version of the coffee crunch cake, but it's not the same as the Blum's one. The whipped cream is very different, the structure of the cake is different, and the crunch itself is incredibly fine, and it has a different texture than the Blum's coffee crunch cake had. Likewise, there's a couple of bakeries in Chinatown here in Los Angeles that carry it. So I really went back to the origin cake mm-hmm. and brought that cake back.
Were you looking at original recipes, that sort of thing?
So the way the Blum's coffee crunch cake was resurrected is the food editor for the LA Times, Laura Zarubin, at the time, she was the LA Times magazine. So it was this sort of moment where mm-hmm. the magazine was really being celebrated at mm-hmm. the Los Angeles Times. And she was doing some really fun stories. And the gist of the story was that for weddings, brides should be able to have, or brides and grooms, I should say, should be able to have any kind of cake that they want, and not just sort of a white multi-tiered cake. And she calls me and says, "Do you remember? Do you know what the Blum's coffee crunch cake is?" And I was like, "Shut up! Yes, I know the Blum's coffee crunch cake." So this became this incredible sort of personal and culinary journey of figuring out exactly how to replicate this cake. And this is really where, I mean, it's funny how I've been researching these cakes now for 10 years and bringing these old cakes back. And I really sort of set the standard of how, of what my process was from the beginning, because I reached out to different people of a certain age group mm-hmm. who would really remember this cake mm-hmm. and what it was like and what their experience was like, to make sure that I wasn't just relying on my own palate, and had some other people taste the cake as well to give their feedback. And I got great anecdotes from them. Like when you picked up a coffee crunch cake at one of the Blum's bakeries to bring home, they would give you a sealed bag of crunch on the side that you were to apply on your own when you got it to.
So when you picked it up to take home, it would yes. be like frosting, but none yep, of the crunch.
Exactly.
Okay.
So we replicated that.
Ah, very nice.
So if you pick up a coffee crunch cake from one of our locations, that's how you get it.
Okay.
And then you bring it home and you put the crunch on, because the crunch melts. Mm-hmm. This is not a stable cake. And I think the fragility of the cake and the time sensitivity of the consumption of the cake is part of the allure.
That
Additionally,
makes sense.
The textural composition of this cake is really, really unique and very memorable. The chiffon cake is gently scented with lemon zest. Then you have the really creamy whipped cream and that super crunchy coffee-flavored honeycomb. So you go from soft chiffon to creaminess to crunch, and it all kind of flows together, and it's ridiculously satisfying.
There's a famous cake in Los Angeles that is made with a whipped cream frosting, mm-hmm. and I just read an article about it, and they said that if you order it for your wedding, they'll make it with buttercream frosting yeah. instead. And I understand why, but it made me outraged. Mm-hmm.
Can you say what cake it is?
Yeah, it's the triple berry from.
I knew you were going to say that.
I knew you were going to say that.
I don't want that cake. I don't want that cake with buttercream.
Exactly.
I don't want that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is an iconic cake.
It totally is. And the idea of like ordering it for your wedding and it showing up with a buttercream frosting.
I don't want any buttercream on that cake.
No, it would be too upsetting.
Heck no.
So you also kind of did this like historical restoration of cakes in two other instances, the banana shortcake from Chasen's.
Many other instances, actually. There's about 10 cakes I brought back.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, there's a lot, but we just don't make them all public.
Well,
because some of them have just been for like private requests.
Okay. So the ones that are available for customers.
The ones that are available for customers are the Brown Derby Grapefruit Cake.
Which, by the way, I know that the Coffee Crunch is the one that people talk about the most, but that grapefruit cake is amazing.
Thank you.
And I think, I wonder if it's like the unexpectedness of having citrus in cake, because for me, that was a new experience.
Me too. And I find it, I always call the grapefruit cake the California girl, because there's something super happy and sunshiny and sun-kissed about the grapefruit cake.
Yes.
And it's also really refreshing.
Isn't that weird to say that about a cake?
But it is. It's really, really refreshing.
Yeah.
And that, so the Brown Derby grapefruit cake is a chiffon cake with a cream cheese frosting of fresh grapefruit segments.
Yes, it's delicious.
So there's that one. There's also the Chasen's banana shortcake, which is two layers of a vanilla cake. And it's the banana shortcake. I did take a couple of liberties with the resurrection of that cake, because originally it was individual servings.
Oh,
at Chasen's, and I turned it into a multi-serving 9-inch cake.
Okay.
I have a theory about that cake that there's something about it that's so similar to a banana shortcake. I mean, not a banana shortcake, I'm sorry, a banana split.
Yeah.
That I think someone was having a really good time at Chasen's one night, and like their banana split melted, and they were just like, let's make it a cake.
That makes sense, because there's chocolate on it too, right?
There's chocolate sauce on it, and there is something called an ice cream sauce, which is actually made by paddling together vanilla ice cream, bits of banana, rum, and whipped cream. And that business is good.
So is that something that you buy wholesale? That a person could buy wholesale?
We don't wholesale any of our
But are there any
cakes.
Like suppliers? Like, is Sisqo selling it?
No.
Oh, so no. That's something that you had to figure
we
out
do
was
it.
Part of it.
Yep. So, and that is part of the fun of these old desserts, is piecing together the puzzle.
That's awesome.
It's really, I find it so satisfying, and I get super duper geeky about it.
I love it.
And, you know, it's almost like you can't extract enough information.
What are some that you have done for private clients?
So, well, I'm currently working on bringing back a cake from Grace's Pastries. And this is really, I haven't gotten it to a point where it should go public yet. It's been a really, really challenging excavation of this recipe, primarily because the lead baker from Grace's Pastries is still alive. He's 93 years old.
Yeah.
His name is George Izumi. I've had a number of meetings with he and his children. His children think that I've brought back the cake to its original splendor, and he is not satisfied with it. So we're at an impasse.
Oh dear.
So that's where we're at. And we'll see if we ever come to a space of satisfaction with that cake.
Yes.
Some other pies, cakes that I brought back. The Scandia apple cake.
Scandia, that place was crazy because it was such a
chic.
Yeah, and it's Scandinavian food, and not only do we not get a lot of that on the West Coast, yes, but to have such an upscale Scandinavian food restaurant, yes, in LA, and incredible, it lasted for decades.
And that's really one of the barometers that I look at when I choose a dessert to bring back, mm-hmm, because ultimately the idea is to make it public, to, mm-hmm, bring it back for people, mm-hmm, so that they can relive these experiences that they had for decades in their lives and perhaps became part of their story. And I look for desserts that were around for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, yeah, at a particular establishment that's no longer there.
Yeah.
Some other desserts are, I brought back Mrs. Johnston's World Famous banana cream pie from Ships. There were three locations of Ships. I'm sorry. They closed right after the riots in, mm-hmm, the early 90s. I brought back the coconut cream pie from the Bullock's Wilshire Tea Room, which is kind of fun.
Yes.
And that one, like some of the cooking, that one I actually found the original recipe on and to adjust it because sometimes what happens is the ingredients aren't available,
mm-hmm,
or maybe the cooking process that they utilize isn't something that I would do.
Right.
They said to cook the custard for 2 hours in that recipe, so I made some adjustments to that and got to a place where people who remembered the pie very well approved it.
Okay.
And that is the thing. Like, I have to get approval.
I have to get approval
from people who remember the recipes.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Because that's the point of bringing them back.
That's really thoughtful that you do it that way.
Thank you.
And so let's talk about department store restaurants.
Okay.
Because basically, when you're talking about restaurants that meant something to people and they were considered very nice places, department store restaurants really filled that hole for a very long time. I feel like my age and younger were really not aware of the idea of like lunching at Nordstrom or lunching, right, at Lord and Taylor because, mm-hmm, it really went away very quickly. But what it signified at the time was a lot. They're actually really feminist, which is a weird thing
completely
to say, but we'll prove it. We'll prove it.
I'm on board.
So the stereotype of like women be shopping,
mm-hmm,
it's true,
mm-hmm,
but there's a reason for it.
To get away from.
Yeah, essentially.
Dot, dot, dot.
The end. So it's totally a reaction to things like you getting out of the house. So department store, mm-hmm, really means a store of departments. Because it used to be that if you, in the Western world, pre-industrialization, if you needed something that you weren't actually making at home, which was relatively rare, you would go to the one specialist,
right,
to find the thing. But as cities grew, mm-hmm, it just made sense for people to group in all together.
Correct.
There was also the idea of people doing their own shopping as opposed, mm-hmm, to sending the servants out.
Right.
And this is, of course, the rise of the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
People who could afford things, but also had to do it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the way we live now. Still,
it sure is.
Mostly.
Except we do it online.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. We sit on our butts more.
Yes.
Which, gosh, maybe some department stores, because I think they're all struggling now, right?
Unfortunately, yes.
They should posit it as being feminist to go back outside the home because of, I'm getting ahead of myself and I should be paid to market for everybody. But anyway.
So department stores, this is so interesting. I have a very deep fascination with department stores, mm-hmm, and a very strong emotional attachment to the experience of department store shopping and lunching. And there are, and I would say one of the things that as a child growing up in San Francisco,
uh-huh,
there was nothing like Christmas shopping in Union Square.
I mean,
the big department stores.
Yeah, and Union Square
is nothing like it.
It seems fancy, and they put a tree, yes, in it, don't they?
They put a tree in the center of, mm-hmm, Union Square, and dining at department stores was actually a big part of my childhood.
Really?
It really was, and I feel like it really cemented a lot of my both visual aesthetic and experiential aesthetic.
Interesting.
And it is so odd that you latched onto this topic because our packaging is based on boxes that you would get at department stores in the olden days.
That's so great.
And this is part of the, and if you look at Valerie Confections packaging, they are these very rigid, slightly bespoke ivory boxes mm-hmm. with gold lettering. Mm-hmm. And the inspiration for those boxes was the iMagnon in Union Square in San Francisco.
Yeah. And iMagnon was fancy, wasn't it?
iMagnon was fancy. And iMagnon, by the time I got to experience iMagnon, it was definitely past its prime.
Okay.
It had the most incredible detailing. And I think that is the really unfortunate thing that we are currently missing in the retail experience, and particularly purchasing online mm-hmm. and, you know, dining online mm-hmm. for that matter.
Yeah.
Postmates cannot bring you what the Neiman Marcus Rotunda can bring you.
Right.
By any stretch of the imagination. And I think that this is what we are currently losing in our culture is real life experience and sitting in a room, absorbing what's happening, taking in the people around you, the care that they're giving, the service you're receiving, the way things are plated, the way it smells, the height of the ceiling. This is what makes a true memory yeah. and a true food experience.
I remember going to department store restaurants with my mm-hmm. grandmother, who was not a wealthy woman, but definitely was pretty worldly. She was a travel agent, so she like knew some things. Mm-hmm. And I definitely remember that going to Nordstrom's and having a vodka martini straight up with a twist.
Heaven.
Was a big
Heaven.
Part of her week.
Yes.
So were you yes. going to department stores with your mom or who?
I first went to department stores. I would go to the Emporium Capwell mm-hmm. downtown. It's now where the San Francisco Center is on 5th and Market in San Francisco. I would go there with my mom and my sisters. But as a very young teenager, my best friend and I started going. We would go on these Saturday shopping excursions together.
Yeah.
And one of our favorite things to do was to have lunch or afternoon tea at the Neiman Marcus Rotunda and shop.
Were you like playing at being elegant ladies?
Yes. Love 100%. We were absolutely. And I don't want to be a bad influence on the youth of today. It's possible we cut school sometimes and did things like that.
If you're going to cut school, I guess that's.
But this is where, you know, this is where I fell in love with afternoon tea.
That's adorable.
Absolutely. And it was sort of like our treat time. And I would do this really funny thing. Like, I've just always been very attached to, I think, the level of ritual in dining and retail experience from past generations mm-hmm. and just the amount of attention that was given to these things. When I was 19, 20, 21, I would go to iMagnon and get my nails done next to like 80-year-old ladies. Yes. And it was just like, yeah, this is where I want to be.
That's
which
amazing.
I imagine might have been kind of interesting in my Betsy Johnson outfit
yes.
sitting there and getting my nails done next to the ladies. And I was just so into it and just walking around. And it was, you know, iMagnon was sort of this gorgeous marble detailed building, and the ceilings were really low, which made it more elegant mm. inside of different rooms there.
Hmm.
And it felt special. There are also, other than restaurants, and I would have to say, like, the Rotunda at Neiman Marcus was so incredible, because particularly during Christmas time, because they do this huge Christmas tree that goes all the way up to the ceiling of yeah. Neiman Marcus. And so you're sort of like sitting around this Christmas tree. And not only, say, mid-century and much later, I wasn't alive during the mid-century, but much later, you still had this small fashion show that happened in the department stores.
Yeah. Department store fashion shows.
Elegant and so lovely. And you have, you're sitting there eating your tea sandwiches, sipping your tea, and someone walks over holding a placard saying, "And this is what we're showing today on the fourth level. You can go over to St. John or whatever." And you nod and say, "Thank you so much." And
that's so funny.
And so that's amazing.
Shows how they really became safe spaces for women.
Totally. Totally. Because that's an intimate exchange that's happening there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
And they would do, I know that the Bullocks here in Los Angeles would do luncheons with the fashion shows.
They sure did. And the Bullocks Wilshire that is incredibly well preserved on where is that? That's on Wilshire right near Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
It's now Southwestern Law School.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the tea room and the entire place has been beautifully preserved.
Oh, that's good.
And you can still go in and take a tour of that building. It is gorgeous. But yes, they did fashion shows there and people would have their salad. They would do their whole thing and fashion shows happened all the time.
So many mayo-based salads.
Curry chicken. I mean,
yes.
On a
tuna in a tomato.
It's all you want. It's all you want in life. And it really does make you feel spoiled, but also safe.
Yes. Which was, it became the whole goal.
Yes.
So when people talk about like the origins of department stores, it's generally credited to various cities in the UK starting in the late 1700s.
Right.
And it's often associated with like London, Paris, New York, Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And I do think that's true in terms of the first cities that opened these types of places on purpose. But I also think it's good marketing to associate it what we traditionally think of as like elegant Western cities.
Yes.
Because I just have this idea that department stores, maybe on the West Coast, might have actually come more out of the idea of like the general store in old mining towns. Because when people, when white pioneers, colonists were moving out, they needed one-stop shopping, essentially.
Right.
And as we like, we've actually talked about this before on the show, the people who made the steadiest and most reliable income during gold rushes were the general store owners. Because they had everything
you
would need.
Who didn't want to be the Olsons? You know, on Little House in the Prairie, right?
Yes.
Nellie had the best dresses. She was a cur.
Exactly.
What a nasty little girl.
Right. She didn't deserve any of that.
I mean, my God, she was so fortunate. Little Laura Ingalls wanted those gumballs so badly that were at the Olsons General Store.
But
right?
Her dad was a homesteader.
Sure was.
Because that's the American way, is to like go out on a limb and try something new. But honestly, opening the only store in town.
Merchant.
That's a better way to get paid.
Oh, yeah.
And then one of these like Wild West minor supply stores became Frederick and Nelson.
Right.
Which was, I think, I can't really remember because it closed when I was still so young. But I think it was one of the nicer department stores in Seattle for a while, at least.
So I would say it's sort of, I totally hear where you're going with this. I think there is sort of a separation of slightly more utilitarian department stores versus really an escalated or elevated, I should say, shopping retail experience.
Totally. So, it's kind of like necessity versus just consumerism for the hell of it.
Like I would say Emporium Capwell, May Company, Nordstrom, there's sort of a whole cross-section of more purpose-driven and larger shopping concepts than, say, Neiman Marcus, I. Magnin, later J. Magnin, which was the son's offshoot of I. Magnin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Saks Fifth Avenue, things like that.
Okay, this just like is funny to me because growing up in Seattle, Nordstrom was like the fanciest place you could go. That's as fancy as we got in Seattle.
The shoe store?
The shoe store. Damn. Roasted. That's what we considered fancy.
No, I get it. I get it. I totally get it. Nothing's wrong with Nordstrom. Nordstrom's fine.
How dare you?
But different. And here's, okay, because I'll go design and interior on the big difference that happens here is something like May Company, Macy's. I think Macy's absorbed May Company. Liberty House was another one that went out, I want to say late 80s, Liberty House went under. The layout of the floors is really, really different in that sort of genre of department store where you've got the totally open area where you go back to something like Selfridge's, Bergdorf Goodman, say, as the origin concept, and then you venture towards iMagnon, Neiman Marcus, etc. You have almost like a lot of shop and shops.
Yeah.
Is this, and there's an intimacy and a level of sort of one-on-one care that happens in those shopping environments that I think are really different than those wide open department stores that I think do definitely have a stronger link to the general store.
Yeah.
It's a it's a very different experience.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And just sort of like the ceiling height, the level of design, all of it. I'm just seeing it all right now.
So there were some things that department stores invented. One of them was free delivery.
Uh-huh.
So
genius.
Yeah. And at the time, that just meant having all the men who worked there carry everything. Which we'll get back to that point in a little bit, because there weren't that many men who worked at department stores. But the ones that did were just carrying furniture out to customers. Taking pictures with Santa.
Yes.
That's very specifically a department store thing.
Yes.
Meeting Santa, taking your kids to meet Santa, wasn't anything new. But taking the picture and paying for it, that was invented in 1943.
Love it.
Yeah. So smart. And then, are you familiar with Frango mints? Does that mean anything to you? I don't know if it means anything to anyone outside the Northwest.
Are they very, very slightly chewy and they soften in your mouth?
Possibly. They're just like little truffle things that I don't actually remember. All I remember is that they were part of Frederick and Ellison's.
Okay.
And then that got bought by Marshall Field.
Mm-hmm.
And the Frangos were such a big part of that purchase, apparently, was that they had all the candy makers from Seattle go to Chicago to teach Marshall Field kitchen employees how to make the Frangos appropriately. And like, you have to use the right kind of peppermint oil and all that kind of stuff.
I don't think I know these.
Yeah, I think it's one of those like super culty, and I don't even know if anyone makes them anymore, but I have a lot of listeners in Seattle, so I'm sure they'll correct me.
I'll be looking this up as soon as we wrap.
You should make them. I mean, I remember them being amazing.
I gotta know a Frango.
Yeah, and I think they're really simple too. I think it's chocolate butter and mint oil.
Huh.
Yeah. So we're starting these stores in the late 1700s in England. We've got general stores on the West Coast. Things kind of are smushing together. And in the 1800s in the West, for middle class and upper class people, middle class being a new thing, life had become really segregated along gender lines.
Right.
Men were outside, women were inside. And that got really crazy. There's this book called Women and the Everyday City. And it actually focuses a lot on San Francisco, but it's about society from the 1890s to the 1920s. And I feel like I could just read this book into the mic and that could be the whole episode. The things that the etiquette books were talking about are, they make me feel so itchy. Life was so constrained for women, for what was being called like appropriate behavior. For instance, no bright clothing. That was like in the height of Victorian everyone being boringness. And it was considered too flashy to wear bright colors.
Right.
For nice girls.
Whorish.
Yes.
Exactly. Also there.
Whorish.
Yes.
And that is a big part with sidewalks.
Yeah.
If you...
Slutty.
Yes.
Slutty women walk publicly.
Yes.
Alone.
I can't believe it. If you were just like, if you stopped to like look in your purse, you were a prostitute.
Yeah.
If you were spending any time on the sidewalk besides getting from point A to point B, it was you were probably
right,
a prostitute.
You needed an escort.
You needed an escort?
Yes.
You were not to respond to catcalling. That was on the women, and we obviously still know about that now. But it was like, a lady should never look neither right nor left while walking and should, quote, never hear a rude remark or see an impertinent glance. So you can't be aware. It's on you to ignore any unpleasantness.
Of course.
I'm so upset.
How could it not be?
I know.
It's disgusting.
This is like, oh my God, I'm like getting sweaty at how upset. And there's something about it too where I'm like, this is obviously wrong and unjust, but I'm also like, so boring. People were so bored.
Sure.
You weren't allowed to look at stuff.
I think they did though.
I mean, yeah.
For sure.
But to be told that you weren't allowed to? polite middle-class women were not meant to be seen participating in the public space of the street. They were to remain as invisible as possible and not to see or hear one around them on the street and not to stop and spend extra time in the street. And there's even a comment, if you look at something too long and you're with someone, you're mm-hmm. bothering them. Mm. You're making them stand and look at the thing that you want to look on at.
Right.
And that's rude of you.
Yes.
So even down to that little level, even among friends.
Right.
Which, how are people even getting to know each other if they were following these etiquette books?
They would meet at scheduled times.
Uh-huh.
In their parlors.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Inside.
Inside.
Yes. So manners followed commerce mm-hmm. in terms of changing mores, because as the department stores, this started in England at, I think it was at Selfridges with the window displays.
Yes.
So window shopping became something that ladies,
yes,
well-bred ladies could do.
Yes.
So it really ushered in an age of women being allowed to just exist in public spaces.
Correct.
It comes from
amazing.
Window shopping.
Amazing.
So again, the whole like, oh, women can't stop women window shopping and ladies be shopping and all that. Like, yes, mm-hmm. for good reason, sir.
Own it. Right?
I'm really on a feminist rampage with this one. Because honestly, like, how can you tell people to not look at things?
Well, it's ridiculous. The whole idea of dictating what, where, how people are allowed to observe.
Yes. It's so stupid.
It's ridiculous.
But I like the point that the author of that book made, I think it was her, that reading etiquette books is mm-hmm. a great way to learn about daily culture
yes.
in other societies and past societies, because they talk about things that are too boring for historians to mm-hmm. think about, like where to wear your gloves and how often to brush your hair and stuff like that. Love it.
I love an old etiquette book.
I feel like you and I were very similar children.
Yes.
I, too, read etiquette books for fun as a child. I was super into knowing
really
about...
into it. The proper way to set a table, the proper way...
Love it.
And then they get really myopic, i.e. how to fold a sheet and what drawer to best keep it in.
Love it.
That kind of stuff I get deep into. And the diagrams?
Yes. Yes.
The diagramming of an etiquette book is, I mean, it's kind of like an art form. It really is.
I love it so much.
It's
I had
so good.
Many Tiffany's Table Manners for teens.
Yes.
So good.
So good.
I have mostly overcome my snob tendencies, mm-hmm. but there's one thing that still makes my brain itch when I see people do it. When at a restaurant, when you're done with your meal, not putting your knife and fork in the correct position.
Mm.
That's still, like, I absolutely notice when people
mm-hmm.
don't do that, and mm-hmm. nobody ever does it.
Mm-hmm.
So. Are you making your kids have good manners?
My kids are, it's hard to tell, because what I know is that my children have very good manners when they're not at home.
Right.
We are always complimented by how polite our kids are.
Okay.
And they are wild when they are home.
Interesting.
They're wild.
What about, so there's polite.
Yes.
And then what about the stuff like the table manners and thank you notes and things like that?
They're very good at please and thank you.
Uh-huh.
Very good at things like that. They're very good at offering to people.
That's nice.
Being generous is something that I really try to instill
okay.
in our kids.
That's very nice.
If you have something, share it.
Yeah.
Share, share, share.
So is that something that, like, when you're training servers or anything mm-hmm. like that you talk about, is like knowing when people are done with their plates or anything like that?
Yes. And this is actually a big thing in the training at our cafes. And I have certain allergies to... phraseology uh-huh. that has become, I think, an issue in our society.
Such as?
I am not a guy.
Oh, okay.
I am a woman.
Uh-huh.
Beyond 30 years old, by far. And I think that a guy, by definition, is a young man.
Okay.
I'm not a guy. And I don't think that everybody should be referenced as a guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I think, an issue within our society, and particularly within the service industry, to reference absolutely everyone. Hey, guys, you ready to order? Hi, guys.
Do you notice it as much in social situations?
I notice it more so in the service industry. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just sort of become commonplace and it's inaccurate. Mm-hmm. There is a specific phrase that really sets me on my heels, which is, are you still working on that?
Yeah, where did that come from? It's so rude and so ubiquitous.
So rude. And dining is not work.
Ah, love it. Yes.
And this is actually in our training materials.
Really?
That people should never say that.
That's so funny.
I also think with a very, I think gender stuff is a point of sensitivity right now in particular. And so to address people in a polite fashion with a non-gender specific pronoun, mm-hmm. I think is the best way to handle the public, such as, how are you today?
Seems simple enough.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
May I get you a cup of coffee? There's absolutely no need to say ma'am, miss, sir, guy.
I agree. Why do people still, the ma'am and sir thing too. I'm like, it's not like an age thing. It's why not. Do you need to put people's gender into it?
To.
Especially because it's the people who do that are gonna make mistakes a lot.
It's an odd learned trait.
Yeah.
That is, it's dangerous territory right now.
Agreed.
So as far as service things go, saying, are you still working on that is an absolute no-no, because I also think that you should be able to decipher pretty clearly just by a quick visual sweep of a table whether people are done eating mm-hmm. or not or done drinking. Mm-hmm. And there are those wonderful cues such as a knife and fork being placed appropriately, mm-hmm. a napkin on a table, say an empty plate pretty much says it all.
Yeah.
And you also don't want to rush people.
Yes.
Right? So hurrying people out, I think, can seem ingracious.
Well, particularly, that's a very non-American point of view.
I know it is. I know it is. At our Echo Park Cafe in particular, people hang out.
Right.
They hang out.
Because it has all that outdoor seating.
There's a lot of outdoor seating. I encourage the hang. We have things like, you know, we always have water bowls for dogs mm-hmm. out. We have things like high chairs. I like it when people spend time in the company of others with an immediate, with intimacy. So they're doing this not by texting. Like, people have chosen to exit their homes.
Yeah.
To sit in your space of food and business and dine, share, experience. And I don't want to diminish the value of that.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is so funny because it really seems like your department store influence here, because a big part of department stores was the luxury for the masses thing, which came around post-industrialization, mm-hmm. which was, you don't have to be a duchess to have a nice time.
No, you don't. And you can also be in your sweats at Echo Park uh-huh. with your dog and have a nice time today, because casual dining is how we eat now, right? For 95% of dining in Los Angeles and a lot of other restaurants, like this whole all day concept, this is where it's going.
Yeah.
And we're not turning back. Okay. Right? So making that comfortable, acceptable, welcome, convivial, I think is really, really important in this day and age.
So that has changed a little bit, because people still had to, in the 1800s up until very recently, they still had to dress to go out, to leave the house.
Yes.
Even though as these department stores got savvier mm-hmm. And like the founder of Macy's, the founder of Selfridges, they came around to this idea of actually making the department stores feel in a certain sense like home,
mm-hmm.
more marble than probably in the average house,
but welcome.
Yes. Welcoming. And that's part of the reason why they hired so many women,
mm-hmm.
which was a new thing.
Yes.
Because they wanted the women to feel safe, and they wanted to really put it out there that women coming into the store, it wouldn't this is so weird to say, but wouldn't damage their reputations by being out and about. So part of the right. way you do that is by having the people they interact with all be women as well. Yes.
But you also think about the things that you need to try on in your life.
Very true.
Like intimate apparel.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
That's a very good and practical point.
So things like that. But then you also look at, I mean, just sort of the relationship of somebody who can help guide you in shopping and have them go get that for you, bring it back to you. They might help evaluate, does this mm-hmm. look good on me or not, mm-hmm. right?
And if you're personal not, shoppers yeah. used to be a free service.
Absolutely.
It's a step above yes. a clerk.
A stylist.
Yeah,
now, stylist. Now they're stylists.
Yeah,
right?
exactly. But that used to just be, you could yes. just show up at the department store yes. and say, I need a personal shopper. I don't know what yes. I'm doing. And they would do that.
Exactly. But I think one of the things that made the evolution of the woman's place in the department store so robust also was the dual earner. Mm-hmm. family, mm-hmm. and also the rise of the single woman.
Yeah.
So we look back to, say, the post-war, mm-hmm. right, was where this really started to shift, didn't it?
Yeah.
So after the time of Rosie the Riveter, right, mm-hmm. and women are fortified. They kept the country together.
Yes.
So we then go out, why should I stay at home?
Yeah.
And just tend to the children. And what if, God forbid, I'm barren uh-huh. or something like that? Or I'm just bored. Or we need more money and I want to travel now.
Yeah.
And can't I participate in the earning? You know, like there's so many different situations that you can imagine sort of jettisoned women out into the workforce mm-hmm. and taking on, say, an entry-level position at a department store, I think was a great way. It's a great entry step. You don't need a degree right. to work at a department store.
And they made it more acceptable for your parents, a young girl's right. parents as well, because they had dormitories
yes.
for the employees.
Yeah. Which is so sexy when you think about it. My God.
It is a lot of people's fantasies, for sure.
Wow.
It's also very paternalistic, and often those things go hand in hand. Paternalistic fantasies and hot lesbian fantasies are often the same. They just have different origins. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In fact, the guy who...
Are we still talking about department stores?
Yeah, totally. They're very lesbian. Because... The guy who started Feline's in mm-hmm. Boston.
Oh, yes.
He called his store an Adamless Eden.
Oh, my God. That's awesome.
It was all about the... I mean, he was a dude who was like, nah, this is lady stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you ever read this amazing novella that Steve Martin wrote probably 20 years ago called Shop Girl?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And then it was turned into a movie, yes. which is a little bit... I don't think the movie catches the sensibility of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and Shop Girl's observations of life at the glove counter
yeah.
is so interesting.
Yes.
And sort of what you take in and the pace of being a shop girl is also really, really unique.
Him placing her at the glove counter
yes.
was a very interesting mm-hmm. move because a department store in Beverly Hills will still have a glove counter.
Sure will.
For no reason.
Sure will.
Yeah. Yeah, that
it's
was
like set dressing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Fine.
Oh, that's such a good way of putting it. Yeah, totally. And if she liked doing that job, not all jobs have to be like fast paced.
No.
Yeah.
Zen and the art of the glove counter.
Yes, exactly. Right? Make one sale every 2 days and you're all good.
Hit the quota. Do it.
So wanting to have people eat in your store
yes.
keeps them around longer.
Yeah.
The hope is that they'll shop, eat, and then be like, oh, and I forgot to get this other thing.
Exactly.
It's like going to Target.
Well, I mean, but if we look at department store restaurants...
Mm-hmm.
And I would say there's two things that are most impactful that affect sales in a department store restaurant.
Okay.
One is creating a full day experience.
Yeah.
Right. So we look to times where a lot of ladies didn't have vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it took longer to get places. So mm-hmm. if you're going downtown to do this, you're not just going for an hour.
True.
You're going for much longer than an hour.
Yeah.
And then you have a meal there and you turn it into a day.
Yes.
And anyone who's ever worked in retail can tell you that the greatest selling tool is alcohol.
Sure. Auctions too.
Yes. Get them drunk.
Yeah.
Get them
real
drunk.
But just the right amount of drunk. Not fall down drunk.
Nope.
Yeah.
A couple glasses of champagne.
Yeah.
Can really loosen a lady's purse.
I love it. Oh my God. Yeah.
Right?
So one of the things they also did was they're like, okay, we've got all these ladies.
Mm-hmm.
The ladies are bringing their kids with them.
Oh yeah.
So they would set up what they called milk bars.
Uh-huh.
Ooh. And that is where the children could eat off of special menus. This one, the Reiki Kumler department store, I don't know if that's how it's pronounced, in Dayton, Ohio, a 1918 special lunch for children menu. It cost 20 cents. And you can really see what the values of the time were because this diet included rice baked in cream,
uh-huh.
peanut butter sandwich,
uh-huh.
milk, and ice cream. So huge belief in the
dairy.
Fortitudinous power of dairy.
Yes.
Yes. And no flavors.
None. My baby doesn't want any flavor.
That's right? Where the idea yes. came into play of both children's menus and the idea that kids can't handle real flavors.
Yeah.
Yeah. So weird.
Mm-hmm. And very white. Very white
yes.
food.
Yes. Bland.
Yes.
As bland as possible. Nothing exciting. You wouldn't want to get a kid overstimulated.
God,
I
no.
guess. Yeah. Here's one from New York in 1927. This cost 50 cents. This was a poached egg with creamed spinach.
Mm-hmm.
What a bold choice, an actual color.
Yeah.
Baked potato, bread and butter, and milk.
Wow. White on white.
Yeah.
Like
plenty
fully.
Of it. Okay, so this was a restaurant for ladies at the Lord and Taylor's in New York.
Okay.
It opened in the 30s, and it lasted until the 70s, and it's funny to think of how recent this nonsense was. Okay, the restaurant was called The Birdcage, and the way that they set it up
God,
was...
that's a chic name.
I know.
Sorry.
I love the name, but I hate
Holy
what they did.
Moly. I mean, can you see the wallpaper?
Yes.
That's a good look.
It's so good. I want it to come back, but I don't want it to come back in the way they had it, which was you would sit in an armchair, and it had a tray
uh-huh.
attached to it.
Uh-huh.
And on each tray, when you sat down, was your free cigarette. Free cigarette with meal.
It's kind of hot though. I'm sorry. It's kind of hot. I don't.
You're a
I mean,
freak.
I am totally a freak. I don't smoke either.
You're just into the idea.
I mean, that's kind of chic. I can't advocate it right now. I wouldn't sit next to it. But I also
It
I'm
just
not
seems so
you.
Silly.
Oh, but so awesome.
Fair. Takes all kinds.
I mean, an armchair, a cigarette.
Yeah. And it was only sandwiches, salads, and desserts, and you would order off of trays walking through the room. Yeah, it's totally your aesthetic, isn't
That's
it?
It's kind of a good look.
You're into it.
It's kind of a good look.
So they, because we can't ever escape men,
mm-hmm.
they would also put in what they usually called grill rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And those were restaurants only for men.
For the boys.
Yes.
That's where they drank the brown alcohol.
Exactly.
And that's where they smoked the thick stogies.
Yes. They literally had different menus.
Yep. And that's where they got steak.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. It was like, so these, they still kept the tea rooms were the quote unquote feminine space,
mm-hmm.
but they had to like let in men because, you know, men wine if they
right.
weren't involved. So they had to put grill rooms in these restaurants
mm-hmm.
and those became very like, I mean, that was obviously like a very Mad Men
yes.
era.
Yes.
Business lunch type of vibe.
Yes. And you think about, in thinking about these mid-century department stores, you can't help but think about Mad Men.
That's true now, yeah.
See Betty shopping.
Yes.
Right?
It's weird because there was this era, and it probably still exists in some pockets, of that really being the expectation of how women should spend their day.
Yes.
Is only being frivolous.
Yes.
And of course, it's called frivolous because it's a women's activity. Oh,
right.
It's so circular.
Yeah.
And weird. So, the types of foods that you would normally see in a department store or restaurant,
yes.
the lady ones. So much again with the salads.
And composed salads.
Composed salads, yes.
They had to be composed.
Yes.
Why? Because you don't want to mess up your lipstick.
Oh my God. That's so good. That's so good. And why was everyone always hollowing out tomatoes and putting things?
Because of the mess.
Oh. Oh, that makes sense.
Because of the mess. And also, you think about tomatoes 50 years ago.
Oh, 60 did they taste
years
good?
Ago. No. I mean, so right now, we can get a luscious heirloom tomato that is just a ridiculous mouth-watering gift of flavor. If you go back 50 years to those red tomatoes that were slightly white on the inside, but also messy.
Yeah.
Also messy.
And flavorless.
So, and flavorless. So you get the exterior was the most flavorful part of that tomato.
Yeah.
And the sturdiest.
Sturdy. Sturdy as hell.
So you're not seeping onto your doily.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Because it was always on a doily.
Always.
Yes.
On a doily.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And then a lot of something that's just gone by the wayside in general, the relish menus and the relish trays. Mm. So you see a lot of pickled things.
Yes.
They would have a chutney on the side of everything. Mm-hmm. Pickled raisins.
Big.
Yeah.
Big.
Pickled celery. Gherkins. Mm-hmm. Never a full pickle.
Well, that would be crude and impolite.
Right, probably, yes.
Pickle out of your mouth, girl. Yeah. What are you doing?
So creamed
a
everything.
A full dill? Never.
No, too much.
Never.
Creamed everything.
Mm-hmm.
Offset that flavor with a pickled something.
Right.
So you get the tart in and then you have dessert.
Yep.
That's all ladies need to eat.
But I'm also thinking about like if you go to the 1950s,
mm-hmm.
right? And again, we're talking pre-farmer's market.
Yeah.
We're talking pre-transportation of produce.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it was a lot harder to get seasonal produce. And a lot of that menu also, and I know this because I'm a restaurant person.
Yeah.
These are easily preserved items.
Right. Because pickled things are preserved.
Yes. So these are all items that can hang out in your refrigerator for a little while. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's not dumb from a business point of view.
Right.
There's something very, very clever about the design of that menu. But it's also just, it's indicative of how menus were formed of the time because of the availability of different ingredients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes more sense. This was right at the height of the industrialization and everything coming out of boxes.
Yep.
And
boxes, cans.
Yeah. So there are some department store recipes that people still go crazy for.
Yes.
For instance, there's a Texas department store. There was, I don't know if it still exists, called Sackowitz.
Uh-huh.
Crab and avocado salad.
Delicious.
Totally.
I'd accept that any day of the week.
Nordstrom up in Seattle, because it's Seattle, the crab bisque.
Mm-hmm.
And then over at a place called Famous Bar on the East Coast, that's French onion soup.
Mm-hmm.
So people really did indulge when they ate soup.
Can we just take a second for the Neiman Marcus in Beverly Hills currently?
Yeah.
Have you ever lunched there?
I haven't, sadly.
So there is something spectacular that occurs there called a cup of consommé.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really unique. And it's lovely, and it comes to you in sort of like a little espresso, like a demi-tasse cup.
Yeah.
And you sit down, and this still happens.
It's very old school.
It's very old school. So, and this gives me, there's something very reassuring about the fact that some of these dining experiences can still happen, although they are very rare now. But you sit down, you have your cup of consommé.
Mm-hmm.
And they do a fruit-based butter. So they do a compound butter that's done in sort of like a little spritz that's on the plate with your roll. And those are some of the elements that I think harken back to this earlier period.
Yeah.
But that cup of consommé, I mean, to regulate your caloric input, what's the best thing to do but have a cup of broth?
Right.
I mean,
right.
We're still doing it.
Yes.
Bone broth, right?
Absolutely.
Bone broth hasn't gone away yet.
Yeah, consommé is just the more delicate way.
It sure is, and it's cuter too.
Yes.
So the consomme happens there at the Neiman Marcus, which is pretty special.
That's hilarious. That's
it's amazing. Pretty special with the pink butter.
Now I want to go.
Do it.
Well, thank you so much for thank joining you. Us. This was a lot of fun. And
so
I
much fun.
Didn't know you were such a department store nerd. Yes. So this was perfect. Really good. Where can people like see what you're baking and what you're up to on social media?
On social media, you can follow me at Valerie Confections. Mm-hmm. ValerieConfections.com is the company's website where mm-hmm. you can ship all of your pedophores, which were inspired by Fantasia
yes.
in San Francisco. All forms of chocolates, gift sets, all that kind of stuff we ship all over the country. I just launched my own website, which is ValerieGordon.com.
Uh-huh.
And I get a lot of baking questions from people, baking, chocolate, cooking questions. That's where you can contact me directly. And you can see where I have upcoming appearances, TV things, podcasts, stuff like that.
Yeah.
You can listen to, see, view.
Valerie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown, just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. How can you lose? The lights so much brighter there. You can't forget all your troubles, forget all your cares, so go downtown. Things will be great when you're downtown. No finer place for sure, downtown.